Good afternoon. Welcome to the Tanker panel. My name is Babi Mitropoulos. I'm a managing director of Weber Sis Hellas SA, a shipbroking firm here in Greece. Before I introduce our distinguished panelists, I would like to congratulate Capital Link, Nicholas and Olga Bornozis and their colleagues for the wonderful job they did organizing this conference. We'll have two rounds of questions, and then if we have time, we'll have a couple of questions from the audience. Our panelists are Mr. Vasilis Kertsikov, Vice Chairman of Elechon Holdings, Mr. Paddy Rogers, CEO of Euronav, Mr. Leo Brodisis, CEO and Executive Vice President of Generate Maritime, Mr. Nicholas Bush, CEO of Navigate, Mr. Bob Berg, CEO of Ridgebury Tankers, and last but not least, Mr. George Saroglu, COO of Tsakos Energy Navigation. Allow me to make some very brief comments before we start our discussion with our guests. We all welcome positive news for tankers, which is evident from the increase in oil demand and consumption, with the IEA projecting world oil economy, oil demand to rise by 1.2 million barrels per day in 2016 and 1.4 million barrels per day for 2017. In other words, we will probably need 4 to 50 additional VLCCs to transport this excessive production. Forecasted seaborne oil trade will grow by 3.5%. Within 2016, bringing supply and demand almost to an equilibrium. We also anticipate more floating storage business in the second half of 2016, which will remove a number of vessels from trading. There are about 57 VLCCs currently on storage business, which is almost 10% of the global fleet. In addition, US exports are to increase, resulting in increased ton-mile demand. At the same time, however, OPEC will potentially cut some production in 2017, but from Iran we expect to see an increase of about 300,000 barrels per day. Last but not least, we saw strong results from the public tanker companies. Mr. Kertsikov, I would like to start our discussion with you and then open the discussion to all the panelists. Based on these above factors, or other factors you may wish to add, we would like to hear your views on the crude market going forwards and product.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for the introduction. I think the outlook is positive, and I would say in one word, steady as she goes for tankers next couple of years. As you suggest, supply is relatively in check. Demand should do rather well. And so I don't see any clouds the next couple of years. But I really think the issue, as much as we'd like to think that Vouliagmeni or Piraeus is the shipping capital of the world today, and if we look around, maybe it's Oslo, New York, London, I think the real decisions that have been taken today that will impact our business past 2 years is really Seoul, South Korea. I think what's happening right now with the yard situation in Korea is a tremendous event that will impact the business, you know, in the long term. So I think, you know, thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands are losing their jobs there. Capacity is being rationalized. The banks are in charge. And I think that will impact pricing decisions of the yards, you know, for many years to come. So I think that's the bellwether of shipping, and we should be looking at Korea for signs what's to come in the medium to long term. That's my key comment, but I'll come back to the two more specifics later.
Paddy?
I certainly couldn't agree more about the significance of Korea, because I think that we know that the tanker market can be volatile, and we know that it's seasonal. Though, you know, because we see that shift from summer to winter. But the cyclicality, I don't think, really comes from the demand side. It comes from the supply side. And people often falsely describe the shipping markets as being a perfect economy of markets. And I think that's completely false, because for most of the time that I've worked in shipping, and I'm sure it went on beforehand, we had on the customer side OPEC, a cartel determining production of oil. And on the shipping side, we had governments choosing to subsidize uneconomic businesses. And the flow of capital into the business was what caused the cyclicality, that if ship owners could get their hands on cash, and if they could go to the yard and they could actually have a free punt on a new building, because they only had to put down a small deposit, and the shipyard with a weak balance sheet nevertheless could fund the working capital of building ships through government subsidy, then of course we had a completely distorted market. So to correct that market, we're already halfway there, because OPEC is basically put down the shutters, and Saudi are now going to say, that's it, we're going to go for market share, and that's their position. So we've got rid of part of the disparity in our business, and as we've just heard now from Vasily, the second part, the key part, will be exactly how clever the Korean government will be over what they do next. If they miss this opportunity, they'll miss the opportunity to guarantee a valuable part of the support for Korean GDP by making sure they have a lean, effective shipbuilding industry with probably only two major yards. And as far as China's concerned, I think they're already going to face letting a lot of the smaller yards go under. I think Rongsheng's gone, Jinhaiwan won't be long behind, and there'll be others. So we should see the capacity come out, and if we do, then we will get back to a market where there could be long-term sustainable returns.
Thank you. Leo, what's your view on this?
I concur with Patty and Vasily, and I think that is the major topic right now that's kind of come and blindsided us a little bit, which is Korean shipyards. I think you have a confluence of events right now in the tanker industry, which we haven't faced before, which is scarcity of capital, and you have public equities that aren't trading at normal valuations, so it's put a damper on the S&P market as well. And now, on top of that, you have the Korean shipbuilding industry, which seems to be under real distress. But I think all of that together is going to benefit the industry over the next couple of years. I think we've had a healthy market, we continue to have a healthy market, and we're setting ourselves up for a very tight market, you know, in 2018 and 2019. So we're very constructive.
Nicholas?
I think I nearly forgot the question by now, but it's crude and products outlook, yeah? I think short term, the market has a challenge. I mean, it's hard for the industry to absorb 2 to 3 years of fleet growth of 5 to 6%. I think it's always been hard. There's been times where, very unusual times, where the Chinese economy has managed to extend that to 4 years, sometimes 5 years, but the outcome of it afterwards isn't particularly pretty. So I think in the near term, There are headwinds. We have to absorb a fleet, and the fleet doesn't really disappear the moment it delivers. It sort of stays around for a number of years. But you know, there's plenty of questions thereafter that go into sort of the shipbuilding and shipbuilding capacity. And for a number of years now, we've been going through sort of a secular rationalization of the shipping industry from a shipbuilder's point of view, and it's likely now to start accelerating.
Thank you.
Patty, I completely disagree with you. I told you I would say that at some point today. Long-term sustainable returns, there's no basis for that in the past. We're a fragmented business. You know, it's the tragedy of the commons. As you said, if the money's there, people will buy ships or build them. And it seems to me that, as Mr. Prokopayu said earlier, the analysts are never correct. Projections are never correct. And my theory is that's true because everything is priced in. And what seems, so we all make decisions based upon what's priced in and what the analysts say and our own numbers. But what drives the market ultimately is some event none of us predicted. And if you look back over the past peaks or valleys over the past however many years you look, it's always driven by something that was not priced in, something completely unforeseeable. An oil shock, 2008 when the economy took a dive, some other event that was not even seen. And if the market is always fairly well balanced, because it doesn't take too much overcapacity or lack of vessels to drive the spikes, that what really drives the short-term spikes, what really drives the long-term spikes, is some event that stops shipbuilding or stops the financing and drives it into at least a secular change. So I don't know what's going to happen. I just know that the most important decision is when to buy ships and when to sell them. And if you get that right, you'll be okay. I mean, the trading and the operations to be efficient in those disciplines is absolutely necessary. That's the price of going in. And what's more and more necessary is to have a size and a balance sheet that can sustain some downturns. But other than that, it's a price of entry. And we're going to have surprises tomorrow or a year from now that none of us expected. So I have no predictions.
So I think everything has been said. I mean, we are coming after 3 years, three bad years, 2010, 2013, of a very bad market for tankers. And since then, we have enjoyed a much better market. I think, the situation has always been a supply and demand driven, and supply of tonnage seems to be contained. Demand is on the rise. Has been a spectacular year last year and this year by the experts, and what we have seen so far in the first quarter, we see demand being higher than the historical average, which is good. As the other panelists have said, bank finance, which is key in whetting the appetite of people to order vessels, is very much in check, and this is really significant going forward. And if we go ahead for the next couple of years and absorb the order book, I think going after 2018, the situation the way it is right now seems to be very positive for the market in which we are in.
We'll come back to the Korean CBRs in the second round. But speaking of supply and demand, the next question is for you, Patty. Does the new building tanker order book create any concerns for you, especially for 2016 and 17? We have approximately 115 VLCCs, about 110 Suezmaxes and 160 Aframaxes, including the LR2s, scheduled for delivery up to early 2019, and almost close to zero levels of scrapping, a number which can significantly improve, affect rates and earnings. Do you think the market has sufficient demand potential to absorb all these new buildings, particularly in 2016 and 17?
Well, I think there are a couple of points just to make about the fleet growth. VLCCs are really, you're really looking at a scrapping range for VLCCs over the last 20 years of between 18 and 22 years, with the average at 20. And we've seen very little scrapping recently, so I think there is a build-up of ships potentially vulnerable to scrapping. What will be the key things? The key things will be the driving up of the OPEX as a result of significant work that needs to be done post third special survey. And that can be quite extreme if the ships weren't properly coated under deck at the time that they were built. So there is some pressure building up on the exit side. And it's like aeroplanes. They can't stay up there forever. One day they have to come in. So I think that just to see the order book in the raw like that, and maybe not really to also look at what will happen on financing. We're hearing already that STX is in trouble. That's four VLCCs potentially cancelable. We hear that there's some problems at Daewoo. There's a number of VLCCs there. So there's a certain amount on the delivery side that may not come the way that it's been scheduled. So any addition of ships, and I don't need to repeat it because you've heard it from me so many times, no new buildings. Unfortunately, we had a rash of new buildings that came from private equity back in 14, which weren't needed and were speculative and were an asset play. If we hadn't had those, the order book would look a lot stronger for us. So there is going to be some testing of the market. But let's have a look at the demand side, which is much more important for us in trying to understand absorption. And the IEA, of course, got it wrong badly with the fall of the oil price. They were estimating something like 650,000 barrels of daily growth in demand for crude oil for 15. They revised it to 900, then eventually it came in at 1.8 million. They have 1.2-ish for the next 5 years on average. That's not an extreme figure because the last 20-year average is 1.1. So demand side looks like it should be reasonably good. But there's a point on the demand side which I don't think has really been picked up on very widely, but some of the oil analysts have picked up on, which is that this change at OPEC is very, and Saudi Arabia obviously, is very, very important because not only are they going for market share, but they've completely reduced spare capacity to balance the market in the event there are any problems. So I think that what you can see with the SPR build in China is that there and elsewhere, people are going to have to take domestic reserves very seriously. Because if the market can't be supplied in emergency on the basis that it has been since 1975, then we're in a completely new ballpark. And I think we will still see China build all the way through the rest of the year. In addition to that, obviously, their domestic production, they import 8 million barrels a day. They have 4 million barrels of domestic production. That started to fall. And you know, when oil fields tire, they tire quickly. So it means that even with nil growth, there will be an increase in demand for transportation. Now, nearly all of that marginal barrel transportation goes on bigger ships because of the ton miles, so it's very much focused on the VLCCs. And I think the oil price will keep us in this good price range, because at the moment, I would say the threat to the oil price is definitely on the downside, because we've got about 4 to 5 million barrels out on production. If you count 2 million barrels in Libya, 1 million barrels in northern Iraq, we still have more to come from Iran, and we have Venezuela weakened. So we have plenty of supply capable of coming on, and we have shale that will come back at these prices. So I think we could stay buffered in a good range for demand. These are the things that would balance it, and that's why we have to be very careful now that ship owners show some courage, because it's very easy to get talked out of this and to undersell your product. A ship owner has to know it's a net back business. Every dollar you give up on the sale, you'll never get back, and don't let people talk you out of it. There are new buildings coming. They will put downward pressure on the market, not because there are too many, but because at the point when they enter the market, they generally discount the market. Let's see how the owners that hold those behave and react. If they're clever and they work well, we can hold this market together, and we can make sure we get through into 17, and we can see a real re-rate in the business.
Thank you, Patty. Leo, how do you see the public companies growing in the near future? You know, what financial instruments and resources are available to support growth? Do you think there will be owners willing to sell tankers and receive shares as part payment? Should we expect more consolidations in the short term?
Yeah, I think public companies are going to grow as they always have through vessel acquisitions and strategic mergers, although at a slower pace than before, just by virtue of the fact of where the equities are trading these days. I think if you look at this panel and you see the names on this panel, they'll be able to access bank financing. They'll be able to access whatever products are available in the capital market to them at this time. But I think what you're seeing in general right now is just the amount of capital that's allocated to shipping has been reduced. And hopefully that has the effect over the next couple of years to kind of edge out some of the more marginal players. I think one of the themes that we've been hearing around Posidonia this year is that asset prices have not been tracking vessel earnings specifically in the tanker sector. And that's been putting pressure on the equities, which in turn has dampened S&P activity. But I have to believe, as the tanker companies continue to generate massive amounts of cash flow and delever themselves, investors have to take a look at how they're valuing these companies. They have to stop valuing them on an asset basis and turn more to an earnings basis. If that happens, I think you see a re-rating in the equities, and I think you see a strong currency from all the tanker companies to be able to go out and buy ships and make accretive acquisitions. So I think that's really, you know, the key in that. As far as consolidation goes, we've been a huge proponent of consolidation. I think between the Navigate Group and ourselves, we proved that last year. You know, and you know, from an industry perspective, it makes a lot of sense, as has been touted, either through vessel acquisition or pooling, from operational costs and reduced G&A. But I think more importantly these days, it also makes sense from a capital markets perspective. I think, you know, investors are looking for large, liquid, well-capitalized companies. And if you look at all sectors, those that are more liquid, trade at better valuations. So if we're able to offer investors who are still skeptical in the length of the cycle a more liquid security, I think it attracts more capital to the industry, which is better for all our market caps. If that happens, and as that happens, I believe that private owners will be more willing to do ship-for-share deals, because then they'll be able to have a share in a public company that they can trade in and out of easily.
Thank you, Leo. Nicholas, as you know, people in the shipping industry, including investors, shareholders, analysts, are well aware of the lack of capital and the limited bank financing available to owners and buyers today. Despite good earnings, publicly listed tanker companies are struggling to raise capital. In the tanker sector, will you view this as a positive factor in the sense that it will keep owners away from the yards, hopefully maintaining strong rates and earnings in the next few years?
Well, clearly it's a positive. I mean, no orders is always going to be better for the dynamics of supply and demand in favor of the owners. But shipping, at least the way we see it, is for most of participants, it's a speculative investment. I mean, very few ship owners order ships because there is a specific need. I mean, there are other industries that have got less barriers to entry where, you know, the industrials will order because they've got a need or the customers have a need. But in shipping, most of the money that comes in is a speculative investment. And the, you know, the science of trying to, you know, second guess the appetite for speculative investment and when it's going to come in is quite an elusive science. I think the only thing you can try and do is understand why it comes and what are the dynamics that are going to be in the future that might attract that capital and where that capital is going to go. So, I mean, to that effect, I believe that the biggest trigger is not necessarily sort of the outlook on supply and demand, but the biggest trigger for money coming into the industry tends to be the rise in asset prices. There's a number of investors, but few and far between when the markets are soft that want to invest in shipping, but when markets start to move, and particularly when asset prices start to move, then you get a stampede of investors. All in all, I would say from 2007 onwards, I think we're right now in a secular deflationary period in shipping, full stop. I think it's driven by shipyard overcapacity, but I mean, if you look at the statistics in 2007, the tanker market was roughly valued, I mean, from MRs upwards at about $140 billion, and we had roughly 350 million tons of you know, tradable ships. It was about, I would say, 2,400 vessels. If you fast forward a decade, we currently have about 450 million tons. We've ordered about 60%. The fleet has grown by 60%. There's about, I don't know, 3,800 vessels from MRs onwards, yet the value of the fleet is roughly the same, if not a bit smaller. I mean, it's less than 140 billion. Right. So it's quite clear that asset prices, and this is tankers, it probably applies very similarly in most other sectors. Asset prices are in deflation, and that deflation is driven by shipyard overcapacity. Now, what we've had in 2013 and 15, it was, you know, things that do happen in the industry, but they're anomalies. They're not normal. You have, with shipyard capacity where it was, in order to move asset prices, you need to have a coordinated rally of different assets. You need to have, you know, the big movers, which is containers and bulkers and offshore and tankers. They all need to go through a period where investors want to invest and you start to order ships. That possibly puts a bit of strain on the capacity of shipbuilding. Shipbuilding then starts to increase their prices. Secondhand prices react a bit more to the spot than expectations. And then you have this stampede that comes in and orders in shipping. Those coordinated forces are unusual. We had one in you know, the early part of the century with China coming out. I think this time it was quite different. I mean, the reasons why containers or dry bulk or offshore or tankers moved were endogenous to each one of them. It wasn't so coordinated. And what we've had is we've had an unusual wave of investment, again, in what is a sort of deflationary period. It's created a short-term inflation. What was unusual as well is it was sort of the nature in which the investments came. I mean, we track a sort of an S&P index in the office, and when you look at the ratio of new buildings to secondhand, I mean, usually for every one new building, you get 2 to 3 S&P transactions on the secondhand market. That's sort of the historical trend. If you look at the period of 2013 to 2015, you've had just about 5% more new buildings than you had secondhand activity. So it was unusual that you'd have an asset price rally that is so concentrated on the new building book. We've counted about 1,200 new building orders for that period, and there was about 1,100 second-hand transactions. So again, you know, it's quite difficult to figure out, you know, when you look at speculative investments, what is it going to do, how is it going to react, and where is the money going to get placed. From our perspective, now we're in a much more normal scenario where you've got more second-hand activity than new building, albeit very low in both sides. I think the driver of this anomaly was the fact that, you know, for the first time in our recorded history, that what we keep records, you had 1 year in 2013 where sort of institutional funds sponsored activity, whether it's new building or second-hand, exceeded the amount of activity that private and Greek ship owners have done in 1 year. We've never seen that before, and institutionals move probably more in conjunction of what they do rather than private individuals, and they were focused for a number of reasons on new building orders. We don't see that happening over the next 2 to 3 years. So to go back to the original question, we still think we're in a deflationary period. Until shipyard capacity rationalizes, the secular trend is deflationary. You know, you can easily have periods of time where the assets start to move up. In order to really make a change on asset prices, they have to be quite coordinated. And you can already see with strong earnings currently on one of the sectors, if the other sectors don't function, you can have rising earnings in one sector, yet asset prices deflating. So the tendency is quite clear. The unfortunate side to the question is that the next 2 years are not going to be determined by the order book that we put in today. The next 2 years are going to be determined by what happened the last 2 years. So your question is probably more focused on what's going to happen afterwards. And we don't think the drivers are there for a significant new building orders coming.
Thank you, Nicholas. Bob, continuing Nicholas' question and shifting a little bit into the S&P business. We've seen limited bank financing and the lack of public funds resulting to a drop of values of the tankers about 20%. Do you see or do you expect any further drop in the vessels, in the values of the vessels? And would you see that as a buying opportunity?
Yes.
Great.
This is an interesting question, but I'm going to be like a politician and answer a different one. Nicholas mentioned that there's a buying opportunity where their stock prices go up and the money comes back into the market, and that happens when the asset prices are up. And I could be polite to my fellow panelists and say that there's a challenge with the public companies, but I think it's actually a bit of a flaw, a fundamental flaw in the public structure of shipping companies. And that problem is that they can only buy ships when they trade over NAV. And they only trade over NAV when the market's hot. In an industry where the long-term return on capital is low, like 10%, if they can only buy when the market's hot, then eventually they'll have a problem because they'll average a higher price than they should. And I think this helps drive the asset price down and actually doesn't help the cycles. As Patty said earlier, you know, he mentioned a long-term return to long-term stable return on investment, which I think will never happen in our business. It never has happened. And I think the public companies get into a trap. I think most of us here on the panel right now think that it might be a good time to buy. Prices are low, cash flow is high. But if you're a public company, you can't do that because it's dilutive to your shareholder's price, and then your shareholders get aggravated, as they should. So they can't go out and buy right now. Private companies can. And I think everyone talks about consolidation. And it's difficult to do big transactions. Nobody wants to sell when the market's down. They'll sell one or two ships here and there on the edges, but they won't sell their fleet. And rightly so, if they can hang on, they know it's cyclical, they'll get out at a higher point in time. So I think the key in this market is what the Greeks have always done, the Greeks with cash. When the market's low, they buy assets very quickly, one or two at a time. And they can move huge amounts of cash around the world because they know the ships, they know the previous owner, they know the cycles, and the sellers know who the buyers are. So they can do that in the low markets, and they carry on. So right now, I think what's happening is some of the public companies and the private companies need to sell a couple of ships here and there, and each sale is a tick down. I think I've read numbers that 70% of the tanker owners own dry ships. That's a problem. A lot of them also own container ships. That's a problem. A lot of them also own offshore, and that's a problem. Or they own real estate or banks in countries that aren't so healthy right now, also a problem. So where's the money coming from? There's no money on Wall Street. I know. There's none there. There's none in the capital markets because they can't raise equity right now. It's too dilutive. So who has cash? That's the question. The banks are not aggressive. We all know that. So the cash flows are high. So how do you marry high cash flows with the ability to move cash quickly around the world? It's really difficult, and that's what's driving the prices down. We bought a ship a month ago from a public company, and we thought we did a really good deal. We squeezed the owner, maybe a little harder than was polite, but, you know, it's our money. And there wasn't a lot of money around, and we thought we did a great deal. Well, a month later, maybe not so much. You know, prices are down again. And I think the charter rates will continue to bounce around, but I don't think there's an underpinning of capital to step in and grab a bunch of assets. And that's the problem in the market. So as they say, cash is king. If you can come forward with a lot of cash and pick off a couple ships at a time and move quickly, you can get a good deal. But I think they'll continue to slide a little bit. Thank you.
But do you have a comment to add?
Well, I think you know that we can overcomplicate things a bit. First of all, it's not just
is that you saying that, Patty? Overcomplicate?
it's not just the shipping market that's deflationary. I mean, we've had from 2000, from the start of the first Bush presidency, we've had 15-year bear market for cash. Essentially, we saw it going through all of that period when asset prices boomed, when VLCCs were earning $50,000 a day in 07, they were going up in value with $50,000 a day. And the reason for that was simply that cash was looking all the time for a home to invest to find some yield because you got nothing at the bank. It basically means we compressed the equity premium, the equity risk premium got compressed to nothing, and that was demonstrated in the MLP structures that came up. This whole position is being unwound as of the end of quantitative easing on the dollar, and even though other countries may do it in other currencies, it's the dollar that matters to us. We're in a deflationary environment. Ship prices are backwardated. Whatever the price is today, everybody's expectation is that it's lower tomorrow. So I think that that's really what's halting people from making a lot of decisions. And on the buy side, as an owner, you may well see a price that you thought was attractive. It's not lack of availability of cash or capital that stops you buying it. It's whether or not you think that is actually going to make any value to you better than doing nothing and buying 6 to 12 months later at a cheaper price. I think as far as a public company is concerned, of course, you also have this thing called cash which gets generated, and you can use that to acquire things. You can use it to delever if you want to, just like another ship owner. But the one thing you have that a private ship owner doesn't have is a merger or acquisition currency. But of course, there you don't have to be fixated on net asset value. You only have to say, look, what's the leverage between the two companies? Is it similar? What's the age profile of the fleet? Is it similar? And then you can do a stock-for-stock deal if you can persuade the other shareholders of the other company to cough up. So I don't think it's a busted flush as far as public companies are concerned, but I do think there's a problem if you don't run a company, you only have a strategy, and the strategy is entirely based on the appreciation in asset values when the market's in backwardation. They were designed for contango, they got backwardation.
Patty, how many mergers have been the past 30 years in shipping based upon share price? How many?
There haven't really been any public companies.
There have been a lot of companies since 85. Most of them end up running into the ground. I think there have been Stelmar and who else?
We did.
And Stelmar was forced.
Ardmore and Navigate.
Excel. Ardmore, that's true. Yeah, and Navigate.
And Excel, Quintana, maybe on the other side.
And the others were related parties, from what I recall. Otherwise, and it's been 30 years, so the currency management doesn't want to give up control.
There's been no, yeah, sure.
There has been none.
But there's not been, you've also not seen effectively managed public companies. Essentially, the public company in the history of shipping last 30 years, the public company has been a straw man for the owner to sell assets to when eventually he thought the market had peaked. That's why we can't look to the past as an indicator of the future. The whole environment around the way that we organize things is completely different. You heard Wiley talking about it earlier.
But if you can only raise money when the market is high, and I believe long-term return on shipping is subpar. And it has to be that way because we're all willing to buy ships today with a lower cash flow than you might appreciate and expect in a different industry because of the volatility. So we all think we're buying low, the market's going to double. You know, it's like being married. The first, everyone's happy, I'm going to make my wife happy as can be. Then you realize it's okay being just content. And that's the way our ship owners are. We're all going to be rich. And then a couple years into it, you realize, you know what, as long as I can keep my hat, I'll be happy or content, and that's good enough. But I think the money comes to the public shareholders or public shipping companies only when it's flying. And that's the wrong time to buy. Otherwise, you guys can't go out and I don't know what the solution is, but you can't go out and buy when you want to. You can't buy big ships now.
I don't think that's correct. I think in most normalized cycles, as we've had in the past, you're trading at NAV, and you can use NAV as a currency if you want to. I think we have a busted model right now because we have backwardation in asset values compared to earnings. But like Patty said, you could still use cash just like you can as a private owner, except that we have a bigger pool to be able to access. Or we could just use our cash and not dividend or not delever, you know, the same options that you have. But I think it's specific to this point in the cycle right now that you're trading at such massive discounts to NAV when you have decent earnings. I don't think you saw that in the past. So I don't think it's a public company flaw. I think it's the events that are surrounding the markets that we're in right now.
I would take Bob's side on this.
I'm outnumbered up here. I appreciate it.
You're right, Patty. There haven't been too many public companies over the last 20, 30 years, but the ones that have been, and there have been some cases back 15, even 20 years ago. Yeah, I mean, what Bob says is correct. I mean, you want to buy at a low market, and at a low market, the stocks underperform. So it's a chronic issue, which has made me think, I don't understand why the bond market in shipping hasn't grown as much as it should, because really I think shipping is more prone to a debt public market than an equity public market for that exact reason. I mean, banks have been financing the business for 50 years. Bond market is basically a secured lending market. So, you know, why? And people repay their obligations, most of them, and then life goes on. So I don't understand why the bond market hasn't taken more of the slack. But that's another discussion. I want to make one more comment on the demand side, because there I do agree with Patty that there's a downside risk on the oil price for the reasons you mentioned. And I think there's an upside risk on the demand side in the next 2 years. Again, the original estimate for last year was 1 million barrels a day. It came out at 1.8. The 1.2, I think, is a conservative number. And I think, again, you have to look at the East for signs of what's going to happen. And I think one thing we overlook is the fuel subsidies regimes in India, China, and Indonesia, and other places in the East, as driving underlying growth in products, which of course drive crude demand. So the trend has been for these subsidies to go away. And given the time lag between the low oil price and when gasoline consumption or diesel consumption picks up in these countries, and the 4.5-5% growth rate, especially in India, 7-8%, I think there's a definite upside risk to demand growth, which should be good for crude and products in the next 2 years. So I would look for signs as far as liberalization is in Indonesia, in China, and India. We've seen huge growth in LPG demand in India, exactly because the governments have liberalized the subsidy regimes or have tweaked. So these are signs of you know, if that happens, then you should be even more positive for the demand side.
Thank you. I was going to come to this question later on, but before we do that, I just wanted to ask George. George, we're all aware that the shipping industry in the past, as well as recently, has been the victim of loose capital in terms of access to cheap funding. Could this, in conjunction with the possible underselling of shipyard capacity, again persuade owners to go back to the yards and make new orders, even on a speculative basis? Do you think this will affect the tanker market in the long run? What's your opinion on that?
Let's hope not. And let's hope not because, you know, memories of the past, the bad market of the recent past have not been forgotten. But more importantly, let's hope not because I think bank finance is not there, so bank finance has been much more selective, and I think it's a good enough reason to hope that the speculative orders of the past will not be seen again in the next couple of years going forwards. Everybody touched on shipyards going through restructuring and reducing also capacity, which is another, I think, positive things. But at the end of the day, everything depends very much on the individual company, their style, and how they see themselves, you know, with the projects that they have. And, you know, if they need at a certain point in time to renew their fleet, because the fleet needs to be renewed, maybe they will go out. Hopefully, they will not add capacity. There are still a lot of opportunities for resales or quality, you know, second-hand vessels. And this way, for the next, you know, couple of years, the market hopefully will be maintained at what we have seen the last, you know, couple of years.
Vasily, going back to what you just said about the demand in the East, as you know, we have seen an increase in demand for clean products in ship to China, which has created new fundamentals in the product market. The use of more gasoline, as well as veg oils, palm oils, and chemicals is growing, as we know. In addition, we see an increased volume of exports of diesel from China. The imbalance created by the lack of gasoline domestic consumption and the excess of diesel is actually considered a good thing. Do you think China's success story for the product market will remain strong and continue to grow in the next few years?
I think so, because if you look at, again, the big picture is car penetration. Car penetration has still a long way to go in China. And as long as there's no huge technological innovation with battery technology, and electric stays behind, as it's projected to, I think there's no problem with gasoline demand or product demand in China. I think I would put even more focus on India. I think the cow-rabbit, similarly a couple of sessions ago, was a little bit politically incorrect and wrong, actually, because there's a huge infrastructure requirement in India. And so India is very, very important, as well as Indonesia. So I think demand in the East is going to do very well, and it has an upside risk. Refineries are, as everybody knows, long-term projects, take a long time. And then as long as the margins are good, refinery margins are good, which is a leading indicator for product rates, then you know, I think the market should be okay. So I think China is fine. India is very good as well. So I don't see many clouds, and the supply should be fairly, you know, it's predictable and fairly okay, except the next 2-3 years. That's why I'm going back to the shipyard issue, and whether we get rationalized capacity and rational price decision making in Korea. And if that's the case, then I think the medium and long-term impact, so the medium and long-term prospects are also very good.
Thank you, Vasily. Patty, speaking of emerging markets, people in the tanker industry are obviously concerned about the growth levers in emerging markets and China's slowing economy with GDP about 6%, which is still a strong number for such a large country, but of course less than the previous years. However, we have seen crude consumption and imports increase for China is about 7 million barrels per day, which is up over 8% year to year, if I'm not mistaken. Do you think the volume of cargoes to be shipped to China will stay strong and increase the next few years?
Yes, I do. I know that, of course, there's a huge overhang of pessimism around China, which comes from the dry cargo market and container shipping. And it's much easier for all of us if it was just the continuation of the booming story, because everybody would feel a lot more confident about it. But the reality is that we never saw the kind of expansion in imports of oil into China that we saw in equivalent to the imports of iron ore. So we never had this huge boom. We weren't part of the infrastructure boom. We weren't part of building China. We've been part of the operating economy of China, and we've seen progression year on year. And whilst percentages are lower, we don't ship percentages, we ship barrels of oil. and the smaller percentages off a bigger base load is still good news. And those other two things I mentioned earlier on, the need for an SPR because essentially there is a real concern about what happens if there's a short-term shock and there's no Saudi Arabian spare capacity to meet it. That's a big issue, so people are going to take security of supply seriously. And the second one is that falling domestic production. So I think that China still represents good value for us and should supply a lot of additional demand for shipping.
Thank you. Leo, we touched upon a little bit the subject of the Korean yards before. Given the constrained financing environment and potential issues with the shipyards restructuring, do you anticipate any noticeable levels of cancellations?
We'd be surprised if the full order book was delivered. You know, Clarksons has already reported some slippage, and although it's common to have slippage from financing concerns, we don't think that that's really what's going to be the material reduction in the order book. We do think, as we mentioned before and has been said on this panel, that the matter of shipyard restructuring is something really to look at. You have the three largest shipbuilders in the world, all Korean, in major restructuring talks. You have STX in receivership and has been told to slow down their building and to halt building altogether so foreign ship owners don't seize their assets. And you have yards like SPP and Sundong, part of their major part of their restructuring effort is to reduce capacity. So, you know, we see a world where there are shipyard closures. We see a world where there is permanent capacity reduction. And I think what's important to note is, again, as we've mentioned, what the order book is shaping up for 18 and 19. You see single-digit vessel orders for those years. So it's not hard to imagine a very tight market as we head into end of 17 into 18. So I don't know if there's much more to say than we've said already on that.
Thank you, Leo. Nicholas, let's talk about a little bit about correlation between crude and product market. People have always had the perception that the product and crude markets are strongly correlated because they're based on the same economic fundamentals and conditions. We saw this in the decade 2000 to 2010. We have strong demand in the product tanker market, but do you think that the rates will remain high in the event that the crude market does not play out? Do you think the freight rate environment between product and crude will be decoupled in the years to come? And do you think that VLCC and crude always be the driver?
Well, I was a bit puzzled when I got this question because I think the question is totally wrong on its construct. But I guess it's kind of thinking back, you sort of gave yourself your disclaimer of perception. You know, people have the perception, and I think, you know, perception is probably a very good sort of tool people use for trading, but it's a terrible business partner. I took and run some correlations between products and crude. I think it's just if you look at, for example, Suezmaxes and VLCCs, that's probably about the most correlated market there is in shipping. That's about, you know, you run the, well, what we tend to run is a 12-month moving average just to, you know, to make it more robust and to iron out the daily changes. There's a 0.96 R squared. That in statistical terms is pretty high. You then look at running an Aframax with an LR2. That's essentially the same ship. One's got coating. The LR2 can do crude cargo. So you would expect kind of a similar correlation. And the R squared is 0.84. Again, in statistical terms, that ranks relatively weak. There's not a very strong correlation. They're very similar assets. If you run a correlation between VLCCs and VLCCs, kind of what most people think about crude, and then you run a correlation between VLCCs and MRs, which is what everyone thinks about in products, the R squared is 0.68. It's very weak in statistical terms. But again, not everyone is a statistician. So if you then run a correlation between VLCCs and the number of British tourists going abroad, that's 0.7 R squared. So I think it's important to understand really what are the drivers behind crude and products. In 2001, for example, VLCCs earned about $39,000 per day. It's not terrible. LR2s earned 40 and a half for the year. So there's a very big misconception, and then part of the question said they share the same fundamental drivers or something like that, and it's actually not true. I mean, crude has its own dynamics. I mean, there are elements where they meet in the Venn diagram. I mean, I think refining margins are probably one of the big elements that have a sort of both tick in products and crude. But you only need to look at 2015, you had a very strong period of refining margins that drove, refining margins usually drives, you know, increased runs. And therefore you had very strong product rates. You also have a lot of crude coming out that some of it is refined, some of it is going to storage. Is understanding really what happens with the parcel that is going to, you know, drive the best investment decision. So I would disagree completely with the concept that A, they correlate, because they, you know, factually incorrect. And I think, you know, anyone that runs correlations, the first thing you do is you run the correlation, then you look at the reasons why you think there might be a strong correlation. You don't look at the reasons and then run the numbers and realize there isn't one. And the outlook forward, in my view, will be very different from each one of those. I mean, you can have periods where they will join, and you have periods where they'll be totally different. And I would urge most of investors to actually try and figure out and focus on what are the drivers behind both of those. The one that is a real killer is, it goes back to the same questions before, is when money comes en masse, and if there's a sort of, you know, concerted efforts for investors to invest, then some of it leaks into the new building orders, and it'll probably kill both the products and the VOCC, and that's why it's not, you know, a zero correlation. But other than that, I don't agree with it.
Thank you, Nicholas. Your point is well taken. Bob, going back to the product market, the earnings in the product market have remained high since 2015, but in contrast, the publicly listed stock prices since that time do not reflect the strong earnings. What's the reason for this, according to you? Is this market misunderstood, perhaps? Is it a lack of confidence from the shipping investors?
I was talking to a major investor a while ago, and he said to me, "You don't understand, we're done with your trade. Actually, we didn't really like it that much to begin with." I felt rather insulted, but I took it in. And you said, is it a misunderstood trade? Or is a misunderstood investment? Being misunderstood, you can correct. I think the problem is when they don't care. And again, it's like being married. If my wife misunderstands me, I can correct that. If she doesn't care, I have a big problem. And I just don't think there's enough market cap to get these investors excited. They can't get in and out of the trade, as they call it, very quickly. Their total market cap of the shipping market isn't big enough to excite, you know, the big investors. Patty mentioned before, you know, selling your company for shares, which is a great idea. And if you know, any of the companies here had a market cap of $5 billion or $3 billion and a lot of volume, and it was a currency that could be cashed in easily, those trades would happen more often. So I think it reverberates throughout the industry. The MRs have great cash flow. Well, they did probably when you wrote this 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago or, you know, 4 days ago. Right now, the MR spot markets is hurting. So I don't think it's misunderstood. I just think a lot of the money that moves in and out of these trades has moved on to somewhere else. You know, the unfortunate reality is, besides the people in this room and the same group of people or subset thereof, we're all going to meet somewhere else in a month or two, I think in New York. There isn't a lot of public money that is really that interested in investing in us. I think that's a big problem. And I know everyone here has tried really hard, and I mean that. And all the analysts have tried hard. We've all tried to educate the industry, financial markets. As I think someone said earlier, the bond market seems to be a bit more receptive, but it's just a difficult trade for those guys to get their hands on. Thanks.
Thank you. George, that's the last question, and if anybody else has any comments. Most shipping gurus will say that the low price of crude has been the most important and positive factor for the strong freight rates in the tanker market. Do you agree with this thesis, and where do you see the price of crude moving towards this year? That question also is for the rest of the panelists.
Yes, I think it the fall in the price of oil that we have seen after the summer of 2014 has helped tremendously, I think, you know, tanker demand, and especially on the crude side. Everybody mentioned the numbers, demand numbers that has been given by the International Energy Agency and other agencies has been much higher than the typical trend line growth that we have seen in the last 2025 years. And in the last 2025 years, with the exception of 2 years, 2007 and 2009, demand had always been positive. So yes, the fall in the price of oil has helped tanker demand, has helped tanker earnings significantly. And of course, I mean, we have seen OPEC producing, overproducing. This overproduction has helped because it, in tandem with the fall in the price of oil, you stimulated demand, you had more demand coming out, and also you had more demand to store, you know, the cheap oil. Because let's not forget that in the last 20-25 years, if you go back to 98-99, the price of oil has been falling down to $10. From there, we went all the way up to 150 almost in the summer of 2008. Then before the end of the year, we were at 30, 32, talking about Brent always. And then from there on, gradually, we went up to $115 in, you know, the summer of 2014. And from there all the way down to $26, $28 for Brent. So significant correction in the price of oil in the last 2 years. And of course, significant correction the other way from February of this year until now, going from this sub 30 to $50 level. If we think, where do we see the price of crude oil moving this year? You know, we think it's going to be range bound, the trading between maybe 40 and 60. We feel this is going to be very good for the industry. The higher the price goes, you have more factors coming in that maybe will push the price of oil coming down again. Because let's not forget, as other panelists mentioned, we have additional capacity coming out of Iraq. Iran has returned in the market. And we have Venezuela and Libya, which eventually will correct. It will not correct in 2016 or in 2017, but eventually will correct. So there's going to be maybe a ceiling of how higher from these levels the oil price can go. And again, between, let's say, 40, 60, or 30, 70, any which way you want to take this range, this is very positive for tankers.
Thank you, George. Does anybody else have any comments before we wrap it up? Let's make it quick.
My view on that is also, I'd be a bit more bearish. I think it's 40 or even below. I think the signs of that is the cost of the marginal barrel in the U.S., U.S. shale, is the price, let's say, leader or the swing producer. And, you know, Saudi, of course, has to cover their budget deficits, so Saudi will have no interest to reduce production. And then shale is making technological leaps as far as producing as efficiently as possible. There's huge demands on the balance sheets of these E&P companies, so the more they produce, the better. So I think the price is naturally going to move down because of that, and that's a very good thing for crude and products.
Well, while you just sort out the play order in a moment, I thought I'd let you. $50 a barrel at the moment, but that's with all of those risk factors of lost production priced in. So what's that worth? People used to talk in the old days about a risk premium of $15 or $20 as a result of political risk. Well, it's all happened in exactly the wrong way for production, and the price is 50.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
I'll be quick.
Okay.
Someone said earlier about the IEA increasing projections by marginal amounts. I don't understand how the price of anything can be cut in half, and the analysts come up just a small increase in consumption. So my money's on an increase in driving miles in a surprise to the upside in China, India, and the U.S., and whether it's 40 or 60 is irrelevant. You know, for our purposes, I think.
nice to. Is it the last word?
You got the
sure.
last word, Nick.
I'm going to change topic then. I just want to offer a different thought to the previous match between Bob and Paddy. I think if you think forward on public companies, and there's an element of truth in Bob's analysis, without a doubt, that if all you can do is go and buy with cash ships when you trade at a premium to NAV, and if that premium comes to the market is hot because the asset prices are moving, then you do have a problem, however well or badly Paddy thinks companies are run. What that hasn't happened very much, but we've seen some of it, and Scorpio has done something on the previous cycle, amongst many things, is the fact that if you think about a public company, which is clearly, you know, owned by shareholders, and where the equity is a currency, I think there's definitely an argument to run through where if the currency is trading quite strongly, and that might be because public investors have a view of the market going forward that differs from the existing, you know, incumbents, and usually they do anticipate it. So there can be an arbitrage early on in a cycle where, you know, shipping companies are trading to a premium of the net asset of its company. You can see a structure if you can offer something to a ship owner where you can give them some shares and you can acquire his vessels on a relative price to your ship. So rather than actually go and pay cash for something, you've got a valuation of X and they've got a valuation of Y. And at least what you're not doing is you're not buying at the top of the cycle. You're using your currency to do that. Certainly, there is a work to be done in that front. The first one is an investor, you know, needs to see liquidity, because the trade-off when you know, we've had plenty of these conversations. The trade-off is, now I've got this bunch of shares, what to do with them? I can't flog them. At least I can sell my ship. Now I'm just part of this company. The second one is corporate governance. And the big problem with corporate governance has been, you know, the lack of investor discipline in that front. I mean, the companies are owned by the investors, and if the investors don't push for governance. Now, I'm an optimist in that front, and I think governance has improved significantly in shipping, and it probably will carry on improving. And the third aspect that would be very helpful is if the cycles aren't as abrupt as we had them before, so that a company that is existing in the previous cycle is still existing when the new cycle comes. And usually there's very, very few of them. I think Paddy's lucky by a couple of months to still be one of them, but many of them, you know, didn't have that luxury. And in that front, if we have a sort of better, you know, structure in the company, but more than anything, if we don't have these really abrupt cycles that, however good your leverage is just going to go down below OPEX. You saw what happened in dry bulk. I mean, there's very well capitalized companies, big problem if you're not covering OPEX. So we get that bit of luck, probably in one or two rounds, we can have slightly bigger companies with better corporate governance that will be able to use that currency at a point when there is an arbitrage, and you can offer a ship owner probably, you know, $1 million more than he would get by selling his ship on the second-hand market.
Thank you very much.
The premium in the end on the merger is liquidity.
Okay, I agree, Patty, yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Thank you all.